Before we get the full episode kicked off, as we end up discussing later on, we recorded this earlier on Monday, so the results of those games were not yet known, and had either Richmond or St. Joe's pulled off a big upset, we would have found a way to get a whole big post-game segment for you, but alas, they did not, although just about probably the most promising combination of two losses that you can have in a night for this conference. And so I did just want to kind of take a brief moment to just hit on two really key takeaways, one from each of those games. The first off being for Richmond, they fall to Colorado by 5 down in Daytona Beach. And there's not too much to really analyze from this game. It was so just ridiculously un-Mooney-like. And Richmond ended up with 6 total assists. Their defense looked great, which has been a little bit of a pleasant surprise so far in this season. Certainly been better on that end than I think a lot of us expected so far. And today, really no exception. But the biggest story is that Jordan King just did it again. This guy is just a scoring stud. 23 points. Following up the 34-point game against VMI he had in the season opener, bouncing back from a little bit of a rougher performance against Boston College. And this guy's going to be a top 5 scorer in the conference. I don't think he can win the scoring title just because of the Princeton that Mooney runs, but he's certainly going to be a guy who's up there. He's one of the best bucket getters in this league, and teams will find ways to deal with him. He's a small guy, but he is so quick. He's so crafty. And honestly, he's about as delightful of a pure scorer to watch as you can have. This guy is really fun. And if you haven't checked out Richmond, he's worth the time. The much bigger game, St. Joe's getting Kentucky to overtime. And you kind of knew once they missed the foul shot, they weren't winning an overtime game in Rupp. And unfortunately, it was old pal Trey Mitchell who really tore them apart in that OT. He ended up with 22 points, 6 rebounds, 4 assists, 4 blocks on the night. Would have been nice if he could have gotten one more, one of the last two. I think we would have had to reward him a triple nickel for doing it against one of his former A-10 foes. On the other side for St. Joe's, Eric Reynolds starts off the game 1-for-7, from the field, and then proceeds to go 8 for his last 10, 28 points. Just like Daron Holmes over the last week, really putting up some massive performances against really good power conference teams. Eric Reynolds put to bed any doubt that he is a top-tier guy, that he is someone who, had he decided to leave, could have been a significantly impactful player, if not even all-conference, on a team like a Kentucky. But we knew that. We knew Eric Reynolds was absolutely great, one of the best in this conference, probably the best guard in the A-10 this year. But I've said it over and over, for St. Joe's to have any hope to be a true contender in this league, at least 2 of these freshmen had to come in and just overtake these 5 starters that are coming back. Running back that unit is not going to be good enough for St. Joe's. And we saw 2 of those young guys make a significant impact in this game. Chris DeSondico actually got moved to the bench after he started the last 2 games. I think he's going probably right back into the starting lineup after today. He ends up playing 32 minutes. He closes things out. 9 points, 9 rebounds. But most importantly was the fact that he was just unfazed by the physicality and the size of Kentucky. He looked right at home with those guys. And no matter what, he is a significant low post presence. And we'll see as the year goes on if the flashes of talent start to turn into something of him becoming a truly significant offensive player, but he'll be a guy who's going to help to bring up this St. Joe's defense to hopefully something better than what they've had the last few years. The biggest one is Xavier Brown, who had a fantastic game last week. Really a huge coming out party, putting up 21 points in the blowout win over Stonehill. He gets the start tonight over Lynn Greer, although Greer ended up playing a ton of minutes anyway. It was just kind of a little bit of a stagger the units thing, which I like. Brown goes for 17 points, 6 of 12 shooting, 6 rebounds, 6 assists, 3 steals. And outside of Reynolds, I think he's the best athlete on this perimeter group for St. Joe's. This dude is lightning quick. He's got a nice bounce to him. And I think he might end up being an even more important piece to this team than Asondico, because they need something different than just this Greer, Reynolds, Brown group all the time. They need the defensive juice that Brown's going to give them. And this being the first time that I really locked in on St. Joe's this year, I was incredibly, incredibly impressed by this guy. And I know they lost the game, and the details of it will slowly fade from our collective memories, but here, probably about 2 hours removed from the end of it, one play is still just locked into my mind. The play that really turned the game, that I think would have been the most important moment had St. Joe's found a way to win. About 4 minutes left, they're down by 4. Eric Reynolds, who at that point had just been struggling to find any open space, tries to force something off the dribble, commits a bad turnover, and Kentucky has a free run out to go up 6 and basically kind of break the Hawks' spirit. Krista Sondico, who certainly does not move great, books it down the floor. I don't know if he got a piece of the layup, but he certainly had a significant effect on it. And then finds a way to redirect the tip-in attempt for Kentucky. Saves the basket. Xavier Brown comes flying in for a rebound, snatches it between two guys, turns around and just goes coast to coast, splitting past two defenders for a beautiful 90-foot layup. It cut the lead to 2, and at that point, St. Joe's really got their moxie back. And any future for the Hawks team that ends with significant success this season is one that involves Asondico and Xavier Brown being all rookie-level guys. Those two are now the massive X-factors for St. Joe's, who, as we talked about later in this episode, they're the high-variance Hawks. You get your butt kicked at home by Texas A&M Commerce, and then you go down to Rupp Arena and nearly beat Kentucky. They're going to be really interesting. They're going to be the hardest team to predict, the hardest team to gamble on, gamble against all season. If they're truly going to be good, then tonight needs to be the start of something special for those two guys. Reynolds is great. Greer's a good player. Cam Brown is a really nice piece to have. Fleming made a few tough plays. Kasper Klocek, dude, stop shooting corner threes. Go to the hoop. That's what St. Joe's needed him to do in that game. But they need significant impacts from those two guys. And we'll see what they can bring this season. So all in all, kind of an interesting day from the league. A 1-2-1 record if we're looking at it by hockey terms. The one that hurts is Fordham losing to Kent State. They ended up going through a drought of scoring 13 points the first 15 minutes of the second half that really killed them. George Mason won at the buzzer. Really crazy shot by Keyshawn Hall. Go check that out on Twitter if you don't know what I'm talking about. But the league marches on. So with that, let's roll into the actual episode. Hello and welcome to an all-new episode to kick off an all-new season of the 3-Bid League podcast. Matt, we are back for year 6. We're like Grant Golden, at least however long everyone thought he was there.
probably more accurate. We're basically Seth Towns now. But for anyone just joining us for the first time, I'm Tyler, joined by my co-host, Matt. Welcome to the show. We got another great season coming for you.
We sure do. And if anybody is new to the A10, new to the podcast, these last 2 weeks shouldn't come as a big surprise. A lot of ups and downs to begin the season. Just wrapping it up with an 0-5 Sunday, November 19th. So, you know, there's been some fun times in the first couple weeks of the season. Just you never know what you're going to get. I always feel foolish about this point in the season, how much time we spend doing our team previews, deep diving these rosters. And I feel once everyone's played 3 or 4 games, you just realize how much has changed and how much you can't predict.
The funny thing about you saying that is I actually feel like less has changed for me this year than in past years.
In what way?
Like, I don't have, like, there's no team right now, and we'll get to this later. There's no team that I already feel like I'm, like, dead wrong on. And typically in the first 2 weeks, you kind of feel that already. Where, like, by this time last year, we could see the writing on the wall that Loyola was just an epic disaster. And maybe maybe that's true again this year, but I don't feel that way.
Some people
yet.
Might see that, yeah. No, I think that is important, and that's something we'll talk about later on. But, you know, 2 weeks into the season, you don't want to overreact to anything too much. A lot can change at this point. There's still a lot of big games to come in the A-10. But do you think we can start to learn a few new things? And specifically, we should probably start with the biggest story of this weekend. Dayton going to the Charleston Classic, playing some of the strongest opponents that A-10 teams have faced this year, and held their own going 2-1 with a somewhat respectable loss to Houston in the championship game.
Yeah, and it's a fun place to start because I feel like your perspective on how the weekend went really depends on who you root for and who you watched. And I take Friday as a great example. I was really only able to lock in on 2 games that day between work and then going to one. And that was Dayton putting up 88 points against St. John's and Duquesne just absolutely boat racing Ryder. It was a great day from what I saw. The conference went 3-5, including 2 home losses to teams from one bid leagues and St. Louis getting kicked in the butt by a team on a neutral site from a one bid league. And like that kind of just defined the A-10 season so far, whereas at least in past years, it was probably more defined by the 0-5 Sunday. At least there have been some good bright spots. And the top of that list is Dayton, getting 2 really significant wins over LSU and St. John's, who both went 2-0 in their other games this weekend before losing to a Houston team that might just win the national title. Like, I came out of that game wondering if Jamal Shedd is the best player in college basketball. And so you would have loved to win that game, but you lost it. Oh, well. The biggest thing for me out of this is in those last 2 games, St. John's and Houston, and I know he didn't shoot the ball well either of those 2, but the Kobe Elvis of 2 years ago came back in full force. And that is a guy that Dayton has to have for them to hit their ceiling.
Well, I think with Kobe Elvis, I guess I'm curious, do you mean offensively or defensively? Because it's been an interesting season for him where he's got to be going through the coldest shooting stretch of his career, but I didn't even realize this watching the game. He ended up with 9 assists to 0 turnovers in that Houston game, who right now is the number 1 KenPom ranked defense in the country. And he's had to handle a lot more of those distributing and point guard duties with Malachi Smith sidelined for the season. So far, he's, even though he hasn't been scoring very many points, he's been a contributor on offense.
And 9 assists is insane because I'm pretty sure at least 4 wide open shots that he created for other people were missed. Because no one could hit a 3 in that game except for Nate Santos. And I think on a normal shooting night, Elvis ends up with 12 or 13. This was a guy that, coming out of the Northwestern game, I don't think we were certain could actually play point guard again. And that's always been a big question. he did not play crunch time against Northwestern or LSU, and it was completely justified because you felt like they had to have Bennett out there to run the offense. You had to have Cheeks for the defense and rebounding, and Brea was just shooting the ball better than him. And at this point, now 2 games later, it's at least to me, it's pretty clear that he's their best perimeter player. And that's the best case scenario for this team. If he can run point, it just gives them so much more flexibility that now when you have a game like last night where Bennett is ice cold and where his small stature was a real disadvantage, you can ride the Elvis Brea Cheeks backcourt, and all of a sudden you become a pretty sizable team on the perimeter.
And I think overall, we can just say the backcourt has been so much better than just the injury-riddled guard Dayton was running out last year. And a couple key stats, I think, to illustrate just how efficient Dayton's offense has been. Top 20 in the nation right now in assist rate. So they are assisting on over 64% of their made field goals. Also shooting a ton of threes this year, which I didn't really expect to see, but they're cashing in at 34% on very high volume, which has led to some really impressive offensive performances. And they really haven't even need to, they're still going through Daron Holmes a ton. And I think we need to mention, I didn't realize how much I needed point guard Daron Holmes in my life, but it's been fun watching him handle the ball. But they haven't need to do everything through him just because of how well the guards and Nate Santos have been playing.
Yeah, and I want to take 2 minutes here before I get into the Anthony Grant criticism segment of the weekend. Daron Holmes becoming a really good passer for just kind of a brute force big man is one of the great developments of the last few years behind Obi Toppin doing the same thing 4 years ago. And the fact that Grant has now gotten two of these, like, essentially at their core, DeAndre Jordan-esque, like lob catching, shot blocking big men, and turning them not only into okay mid-range and actually now acceptable 3-point shooter for Holmes, who by the way is making his foul shots this year too, but turning both of those guys into legitimate playmakers is really a testament to the player development piece of this team. Which is the part that I think kind of goes unnoticed with Grant. We praise the recruiting, we trash some of the in-game play calling, and I mean like the collective, everyone watching him. He does not get credit for the player development piece. And he has taken another really talented guy and turned him into a superstar. But on the flip side, you mentioned the 3-point shooting. That number went down a lot in the last 2 games. They were top five in the country coming out of that LSU game, and then kept it rolling in the first half against St. John's, where they were just jacking up threes like madmen. It was like watching Billy Lang take the clipboard for them. And they really calmed it down in the second half of that St. John's game. And it's a combination of three things that kind of all intertwine. They stopped running that horizontal weave BS that Grant just loves so much. That, by the way, all of the best Dayton offenses just stopped doing that eventually. And they started empowering Kobe Elvis to just attack like a madman. That's what opened up his game. And that's what really opened up the offense as a whole. They stopped shooting threes as much. And the threes that they were getting were of significantly better quality because they were coming out of kickouts. And if Elvis and Bennett are just attacking the rim with reckless abandon, they're going to start to turn the ball over a little bit more. I think that's what Grant is probably fearful of. But that's their best case scenario. You're going to stop getting teams that can so comfortably double team Daron Holmes. You're going to start seeing Brea and Bennett get more open threes so that they're not just chucking from NBA range. And I think as this year goes on, I think we're going to see this team become a better and better offensive unit. And they're already an awesome defense if we just pretend that that first half against St. John's didn't happen.
Yeah, that's actually one issue I wanted to bring up. I'm not sure the defense has been as awesome this year, and it's still been good, don't get me wrong, but this year their opposing effective field goal percentage has jumped from about 40% to 50%, where the past 2 years it was at a nationally elite level, and now it's kind of just average. I feel like the press defense has been outstanding. I mean, look at the second
Always
half of
is
the
with him
LSU game.
since Grant's gotten there.
Yeah, I mean, but especially adding Javon Bennett, I mean, his energy on the court forcing these turnovers has been so much fun to watch. In the half court, I'm not sure the defense is quite as strong this year, and I think part of that is just losing to Monte Kamara, losing an excellent defender who can guard anybody on the court. You're obviously going to take a hit, but between that and just the struggles in defensive rebounding and the two losses so far against Northwestern and Houston, those are big teams. It's not that big of a surprise that Dayton had trouble in that area, but I mean, overall, you're seeing this team come together and having a pretty well-balanced team where they're not struggling too much in any one area right now.
Yeah, I'm not too concerned about the defense. They've played four straight pretty good offenses. And in each of those games, it was one little segment of time. It's the last 5 minutes of the first half against Northwestern that killed them. It was the first like eight of the second half against LSU, the end of the first half against St. John's, and then the first like basically 12 minutes of the game against Houston when Shedd and Cryer went inferno. And they're definitely going to have to clean that up. You can't be giving up a massive run to a good team every time you play them, but I felt like the defense was really good for the majority three quarters of those games. And that'll be something that's interesting as you play some lesser offenses on good teams like a UNLV, like an SMU. Does that happen again? As for the rebounding, I'm not concerned about it because it was awful last year, and I have no hope that it's going to be any better this year. They're just going to keep giving up offensive boards, and they just have to hope that it doesn't kill them on the wrong night. I just don't see a path to that getting better.
And I do think some of these numbers you would expect to get better as Dayton plays a little bit easier competition here in the next few weeks. But I think you have to take this 3-2 start as a pretty big success, going 2-2 against high major teams, all from power conferences. Now, through these 2 weeks, with a lot of questions going around in the A-10, what are your thoughts on Dayton as the favorite of the conference? Are they solidly in that position right now, or is it too early to call?
Well, one thing I want to note as well, this four-game stretch basically determined whether or not they're an at-large contender. And I said that in October, they had to start 3-2 at worst. Now, this is probably the best-case scenario of a 3-2. Neither of their losses will hurt them in the slightest way possible come March. Those are two good teams in tough environments you lost to. Picked up two should-be good Q2 wins. They're absolutely right in the middle of the conversation for that right there. In terms of favorite, yeah, this justified really any questions, at least that I had, that they're the best team here and that this is theirs to lose. And that's despite losing Malachi Smith. Like, I came out of this weekend with three big takeaways that really lock this in for me. Number one, as I just went over, Kobe Elvis looking like the Kobe Elvis of old, a guy who can run your offense, who can. Him, Bennett, and Cheeks together on the perimeter is a pretty daunting perimeter D. Number two, we have how the hell have we not talked about Nate Santos yet? Who's basically just doing like a discount to Monte Kamara impression here. Like, and this will sound like an insult. It's not when you remember that Tumani Kamara should have been Defensive Player of the Year in the A-10 last year. And honestly, you could have made an argument was truly better than Holmes. Nate Santos is just doing like a B plus version of Tumani Kamara at this point. And this was a guy that I never understood why he was not playing at Pitt last year. He's doing everything he did there just on a grander scale. He can space the floor for them. He's a pretty good defender. I'd like to see him rebound a little bit better to catch up to Kamara's incredible elite rebounding. But Dayton now has a clear second and third best player to go with Deron here. Two guys that I think are clear all conference contenders at this point. I think if I wrote up my team right now, I might just go ahead and put Nate Santos on that team. He's been remarkable. And then the last one, and it's a small one, and you texted me a stat about him last night. Zimi Nwokedji, who was
He's
awesome as a
back.
freshman, and then just basically just became useless for two entire years and then comes back, pops into the rotation, misses a bunch of defensive assignments immediately in his first 5 minutes of meaningful time this year. And I'm thinking, like, okay, so this is the Zimmy of the last 2 years again. He's done. We're never going to get a contribution from him again. This weekend, he plays 20 minutes. He doesn't miss a shot. He made some nice plays defensively. And all of a sudden, I like really trust him as a seventh or eighth guy again.
Yeah, I mean, his contributions were pretty impressive after not getting into the game at all the first two games of the season. I think overall, for the points you mentioned, Dayton right now is playing the best in the A-10, and I do think they are the favorite, but I don't want to go too far and say it's their conference to lose yet. I mean, just to bring up a few things that have happened in the first 2 weeks of the season in recent memory, last year we had St. Louis comfortably beating Memphis, who ended up being a tournament team. On the same night, Dayton lost to UNLV, so all of a sudden, it seemed like the tides were turning and the Billikens were the big favorite. Not so. How about 2 years ago when St. Bonaventure won the Charleston Classic and then kind of fell apart in January? And I mean, the other one that came to mind, VCU beating Will Wade with the FBI guys in the crowd at the Siegel Center, looked like they were going to feed off that into a huge non-conference, and it just never really happened. So I think right now Dayton's playing the best. If you look at the sports books, they're around a plus 250 favorite, which I think is a fair number. But I certainly wouldn't go much further than that and say it's, a 50-50 at this point.
I think part of the issue is there's no clear number two at this point, but the expectation was set a few weeks ago. Like they should have always been the team to beat in this conference, and I think we're all afraid to trust them because of the fact that they didn't come through last year. And those are some great examples. Like I kind of think of them along the lines of that VCU team in 2019, where they were just clearly more talented than everyone else that year, and they should have taken the conference by storm, but they just, well, twofold. Number one, none of us realized how incredible Dayton was that year. But number two, VCU should have been an easy NCAA tournament, a clear second place team. Marcus Evans gets hurt and they epically collapse. Just truly, truly just crater in a way that I still have not seen from another team in this conference since we've done this pod. It was just such an oddity. Like St. Louis last year, we still knew they were flawed. And Bonaventure the year before that, I think I probably would have put them in the same boat. But a lot of other people were screaming about their flaws at that time.
So speaking of a number two, I think we'd agree there isn't anyone that clear right now. I mean, you mentioned VCU, who has been off to a rocky start at the beginning of their season. Saint Bonaventure continuing their tradition of losing to a MAC school. Seems like it might be Duquesne, who's 4-1 with maybe the toughest epitome of brutality you could have against a Princeton team that just made the Sweet 16.
I wanted to put them two. I talked myself out of it. I put them at three, and they've been the second best team through these first 2 weeks. They, like you mentioned, the tough loss to Princeton. They're going to have a lot of games like that coming up. They play UC Irvine next week, who's actually even better than Princeton in another bye game at home. Them just kicking the crap out of Charleston. And I know Charleston then also didn't put up the best week after that, but that was pretty telling to me. Like Duquesne just hasn't won a truly great non-conference game in, God, I don't know, since they beat Pitt in 09. Like they've played so many terrible non-con schedules for years and years and years. And they finally come out in a game with big expectations and win. We're going to learn a lot the next 2 weeks, whether or not they're for real. At Nebraska, and then that home for UC Irvine game. If they come out of that stretch 2-0, they're a contender, and they might even be an at-large contender. If they just get their butts kicked in those two, then it might just be business as usual for the Dukes. But one thing that I want to talk about that I think has probably gone unnoticed, given that they played three bye games this week during other games while big tournaments were going on. I'm assuming a lot of people did not focus their eye towards like Duquesne and Rider or Duquesne and Cleveland State on opening night. Trey Clark might be a top five player in this conference right now. He took a huge, huge leap from the summer, and his late season 3-point shooting boom is for real. Like he is just a consistent high 30% guy at this point. What he did at the beginning of last year, I think we can write off as a fluke. But the biggest difference is he is a legitimate offense starting playmaker. He's their backup point guard now when Kareem Rozier comes out of the game, and he's done an incredible job at it. It's such a stark difference from the guy that we saw last year early in the season who was so turnover prone, and he still gets sloppy with the ball, but the dude's number two in the A-10 in assist rate right now, behind just Neil Quinn, who's just putting out like an unrealistically Jokic-esque awesome number. But Trey Clark has now turned himself into this all-around offensive dynamo to go with the fact that either he or Kyle Rose is the best perimeter defender in this conference. And Duquesne now has this incredible two-headed monster where it's incredibly realistic to see the path to Clark and Day-Day Grant both being first-team all-conference guys.
I mean, I think that might be what it even takes for Duquesne to win the conference, and that wouldn't be a tremendous surprise. But I think what really stands out too is that Clark is pretty much matching or even exceeding all of Day-Day Grant's offensive production, which
He
going into
might
the
just
season,
be
it
better than Grant, which is insane to say.
not something we would have expected with how well Grant shot the ball last year, for sure.
Yeah, and
So I get.
he's I just want to throw in, he's still Trey Clark. He kind of disappeared in their last game because they got a huge lead, and so all the stars got some extra rest, and then he ended the game by chirping at an assistant coach from Ryder in the handshake line. So vintage Trey Clark forever.
It's all fun and games, but yeah, like you said, though, it is going to be a huge week for Duquesne coming up. That Nebraska game, I mean, kind of hard to tell because Nebraska hasn't played anybody of note yet. Their best game is against Oregon State, who's one of the worst Power Five teams in the nation, but they've won every game by double digits so far. So that's going to be a difficult test for the Dukes, and certainly would be a huge win if they wanted to build anything resembling an at-large resume.
Yeah, and Nebraska tied for the nation's third longest active win streak right now at five. So that's fun.
All right, so let's get into a discussion of the rest of the conference. And this goes back to our final preseason podcast where we both agreed there's a solid top seven and bottom eight. We had that same divide, even though our order for the teams was much different. But as you all know, things have changed a bit in the last 2 weeks. And I wanted to start this off for the teams that we both agreed were in the bottom half to start the year. Who has stood out to you the most as someone who could make some noise that you expect to have the best season right now?
I'm really starting to talk myself into GW here. 4-0 against admittedly crappy competition, but they've also covered three of those games. So it's not like they're just going out and just sneaking these out like some of the other lesser teams in the conference. But to me, this is a team that just failed the eye test over and over and over again last year. And they really just kind of outperformed their talent. I just flat out think they have a better roster than last year already. They look so much more athletic. They look so much more dynamic. They have a real bench. They actually have guys who can reliably shoot outside of just hoping that either Bishop or Adams gets hot on the right night. I mean, James Bishop actually isn't even having that great of a start to the season by his standards. Neither is Maximus Edwards. But a guy that I won't talk about too much now because we have a specific category later and I want to praise him then. Garrett Johnson's going to be a star in this league. I actually think it's going to happen much, much sooner rather than later. But this is a dude who will make at least one all-conference team before it's all said and done. And I like all these just random pieces that they can rotate around in the front court between him, Schroeder, who still hasn't really come alive, Darren Buchanan, who I don't know how, got a triple nickel the other night, playing the power forward spot and just getting assists off of kickouts. Babatunde Akinbola, I don't want to say that wrong, but
I think we just need to call him Stretch. I'm pretty sure that's
a guy who has like zero offensive skill, but is a defensive menace at the rim. And like, this team's just a lot more fun than last season. There's the front line's so much more athletic than that Dean and Lindo combo. And then Trey Autry, who I'm pretty sure is going to have like five of the worst games that we see from anyone this season, where he's just chucking up shots and goes like 0 for 8 from 3. But he's going to get cooking in a few of them too. He's kind of like a younger, like an early sophomore year James Bishop in that regard.
I think GW is probably the answer right now. They've certainly been the most fun of these projected bottom teams to watch. And I think we need to take it with a little grain of salt, because outside of Hofstra, who's a decent mid-major, they haven't played anybody yet. But the key for me, I'm not that surprised there's still an up-tempo, efficient offense, because I think Caputo just runs a good system, and having Bishop at the top of that is going to be huge. But they actually play defense this year, which is a huge surprise. And you mentioned Akinbola, but we didn't really know how much strength GW is going to have up front. And between him, Garrett Johnson, and Darren Buchanan, all of a sudden they have a ton of length in the front court. And right now they are fourth in the country in defensive block rate, which is wild to think about considering where they came from last year. They're also not getting torched from three on a regular basis. They're actually, 25% allowed right now on threes. If this defense is legit, once they start facing quality opponents, we could see this team go pretty far, because I'm pretty comfortable saying it's going to be a good offensive team.
Yeah, and as great as Brendan Adams was last year, like, it was a big problem that at times it felt like he was their most reliable defender. And I think probably overall Lindo and Dean were better defenders, but they were so inconsistent on that end. And Adams was just clearly so far and away better than Bishop and Edwards on the outside. And they just couldn't survive with three fully offensive focused smaller guys on the perimeter at all times. And now having Johnson playing the three sometimes, having another more offensively focused athlete, but a guy who's so quick in Autry. And then when they go bigger and slide Johnson down to the three and all of a sudden just become this huge team, it makes a lot of sense.
The other team that I think could be the answer to this question, and I am starting to feel comfortable that they do have a legitimate defense, George Mason, off to a nice 3-1 start at the time we record this, coming off a tough loss to Charlotte, the team they replaced in the A 10 years ago. But I like what I see from the Patriots, and I think part of our preseason prognostications were just that we didn't know what was going to happen with a new coach and so many new faces. But overall right now, their size has been huge. I think limiting opponents to about 38% on 2-point attempts. And I want to save some time later in the pod when we have some segments coming up, but Keyshawn Hall has just been incredible in pretty much all facets right now as an all-around player. You know, dribbling, shooting, and rebounding has been off the charts. So I feel like I might have been too low on the Patriots. And going in, I could definitely see them going over 500 in the league, especially when you consider that they really haven't gotten anything out of Ronnie Polite so far. I mean, he's averaging 6.5 points a game right now, and you got to figure he's about to pick it up at some point soon.
Yeah, and Amari Kelly, who is now playing a huge minutes load after they unexpectedly lost Nicholas Pivret to pro ball like 3 days after the season started, is having a massive career performance right now. And those are two guys that I think we talked about as potential impact transfers who just appear to be a lot closer to their ceiling than their floor so far. Some of the other guys in the conference that fit that bill, Santos, like we talked about, Jordan King over at Richmond. And like, Richmond doesn't fit in this category for me, but I also am pretty certain that I was wrong in having them as one of the worst teams in the league. they're closer to the 8-9 game than the bottom of the conference at this point. Jaden House at Rhode Island, Zeke Montgomery over there, two other guys who are playing well. But yeah, I agree. I probably still have the Patriots slotted in the 8th spot where I had them to begin with. And I should give a quick disclaimer. I should have done this at the beginning of the episode. We're recording right now on Monday night. St. Joe's and Richmond both play top 25 teams coming up. If they won those games, you probably will have heard a post-recorded opening about that now. But on the flip side, George Mason is playing in the proverbial internet forest right now on some online service that no one can get. And Fordham's on in the background. So if either of those two do something surprising in this game, that might tweak some of the stats that we've thrown out about them here.
Yeah, very well could. And hopefully we get some good news at the end of this. But on the other end, I think we do need to talk about top-end teams that have disappointed so far. Right now, who from your projected top seven going into the season are you not feeling confident in and that you think could potentially end up under 500 in the league?
Well, that's part of why I just gave this disclaimer, because I poke my eyes over to the TV and Fordham has 39 points late in the first half after just a remarkably incompetent offensive showing to start the year. And they're my pick right now. I know a lot of people would want to say St. Joe's, but we warned everybody they were going to lose at least one horrible game. It would
yeah,
have
we
been
didn't
nice
know it would be Texas A&M Commerce, though.
It would have been nice if it wasn't to a team in their 12th day as a Division I program. But like going into this Kentucky game, it doesn't change my opinion at all that Reynolds and Brown could just get scalding hot from deep in this game and they could actually beat Kentucky. We said that from the beginning. They might beat one of these awesome teams they play and just look like bums against a crappy team in a bye game. And that's what happened. So my opinion on St. Joe's is unchanged. We can talk about Loyola as well. I don't know if that might be your team, but to me right now it's Fordham. And we said from the beginning they have a chance to be the best defense in the league, but they had to find a way to just be really like below average on offense as opposed to bad. They're not even bad. They're just flat out putrid. They're one of the worst three-point shooting teams in the country, which isn't helped by the fact that they're not making shots at the rim this year, which they were at least decent at last season. They're bottom 30 in free throw percentage, and they're just dragging down what has the chance to be another special defense where they're defending the three at an excellent rate, just like last year. They're giving up a little bit more at the rim without Moore and Nowitzki, but they're making up for it by forcing a ton of turnovers this season. I'm struggling to see where the offensive production is going to come from. The Will Richardson breakout that I predicted is showing zero signs of life to this point. Jafet Medor is kind of doing what he can, but he's no Darius Quisenberry. And God, I'm starting to feel bad about my criticism of Darius Quisenberry, who was a high volume, good numbers guy. And I criticized him for it. Well, it's getting pretty clear that he had to have that high volume for them to survive.
I think that's right. I mean, you already mentioned Richardson not meeting our hopes and expectations, but I also look at the two senior leaders of this team, Kyle Rose and Antrell Charlton. At the time we're recording this, they're combining for 8 points a game, and they're both shooting under 30% from the field. I know they're both defense-first players, but you just got to get more from your experienced players. But you are right. Loyola, I think, is going to be my pick for this. And what it comes down to for me, and part of it, I am sticking to my guns a little bit. Yes, I did pick Fordham third place, which doesn't look great right now. But to me, Fordham earned the benefit of the doubt a little bit, where they finished third place last year. And they didn't really blow us away in the non-con. They racked up a ton of wins, but they didn't look that good doing it. And all of a sudden, they got to midway through the conference season, and they were a very tough out. Loyola has not earned any of that trust from me. I see a lot of the same weaknesses as last year. They're not turning the ball over quite as much, but it's still a pretty big issue. Defensively, it's a little bit better. I think a lot of that comes at the rim with Miles Rubin and Dame Adelican shoring up the front court, but it's still just a team with a lot of flaws. And I think what it comes down to, I talked about this going into the year, but I didn't know with all the experience transfers if they would find a rotation that works. And at the end of the day, you called this out at the end of their UIC game that they lost, but in crunch time, they're still giving a lot of important minutes to guys who struggled last year and guys who were part of a losing team rather than relying on some of the transfers. And I just don't know if that's going to work.
Look, this week was a flat out shit show. Blowing its second half double digit lead to UIC at home and then barely beating a way worse New Orleans team on that same court. I'm willing to forgive it for two reasons right now. Number one, they did not have Olsen for any of that. And I think they survived the UIC game if he doesn't get hurt there. Number two, you talked about it. This rotation is a disaster. I have no idea what they're doing. Like, this is pure just whipping 10 darts at a concrete wall and just seeing which one puts a hole in it. Like, I like Thomas. I like Thomas Welch. He's one of my favorite random role players in this league, and he would be a huge asset to multiple teams in this conference. Like, throw him on St. Louis, and he'd be a huge contributor. He's their third best center. He can't be playing crunch time. And then the New Orleans game plays 21 minutes. Like, Adelakun gives you some excellent two-way play. By the way, that New Orleans game, Adelakun plays 22 minutes. He has 21, he's 22 points and 11 rebounds.
Also,
This
his
dude,
first start of the year,
yeah,
by the
he
way.
was all conference in the Ivy League. But by the way, I can forgive that a little bit because you're trying to figure out what you have in Rubin, who is a defensive menace already, and it could really be a special player. But like, if those two are healthy, I just want to see them. And even when you get Alston back, like, I kind of like the idea of experimenting with this quicker offensive stud with a defensive stud lineup where you just play Alston and Mwamba together. And there's just not a place for Welch. And then, like, I'm just looking at this again. Lewis playing 11 minutes in that game. What in the hell is going on with Ben Schwager,
He's benched.
who was their second best player at the end of last season, wasn't in the rotation until the UIC game, finally got in the second half, played well, and then played 1 minute against New Orleans. Like, this is where we need an insider here, like someone who has a connection to like a manager on this team. Please let us know if Schweiger and Drew Valentine are just in some epic feud, or like he's just not showing up to practice or something, because if there's not something terrible going on behind the scenes, then this is nonsensical why he's not playing. But let's give it like 2 weeks. Let's see if they figure this out, because to me, I kind of can see the path as to who their nine guys are. It's Norris, Watson, Alston, Adelakun with Rubin backing him up, Dolan or Schweiger with the other one backing that one up, Mwamba off the bench, and then you play Jalen Quinn 5 minutes, see if you're going to get the excellent, holy hell, this dude could be a stud Jalen Quinn, or this dude has just thrown the ball to the other team 4 times in 3 minutes Jalen Quinn. Because whichever one it is, you kind of just get for the full game. You can test that out early and figure out if you want to play him in the second half or not. But yeah, that part is just a mess.
I'm out. I know I preached like 2 minutes into the pod. Don't overreact. Don't overreact. The same warning signs, they're flashing in big red letters right now. They were there last year. I think this is a bottom four team until they prove to me otherwise. There's too many other bottom end teams that we didn't like that are off to a good start where I can't just definitively say Loyola's better than Rhode Island or Richmond right now. Or, I mean, even UMass dropped 100 points the other night. I'm just out, and they need to have some good games against good teams.
I'm
So.
too far in on the roster right now. I just think that this is so clearly a top half roster. But we'll see what goes on with the coaching and the execution the rest of the
Well, I
way.
mean, and to be fair, I mean, that's going to be me with Fordham until they lose this Kent State game by 15 in the second half. But, you gotta stick to your guns a little bit. And I didn't really have any guns on Loyola anyway going into the year, so it's easier for me to back off on them.
And we didn't even discuss this beforehand, and I knew I could just save my Loyola thoughts because you would just roll right into it.
Yeah. All right. I think you have our next segment on a couple of fun players we want to talk about.
Yeah, so we had three little categories here. The first one is just a breakout player that we did not expect. And I want to kick this off with a guy who got national attention in the first week, made podcast appearances, I think, on both the A10 Insider and the DMV Hoops pod, had an ESPN story about him. And for those who don't know, Garrett Johnson, the GW freshman, who's actually been in college now 3 years, even though he's just making his debut onto the basketball court, a cancer survivor, went through treatment for a year and a half. His original treatment didn't take. He had to fight through chemo last year. And it's a wonderful story. The dude has beaten the disease and is now back to getting to do what he loves and what he's good at. And the focus has rightfully been on that, which is just ignoring the fact that Garrett Johnson is an awesome player. And he's won Rookie of the Week back-to-back weeks. So if you take that, then yeah, duh, he's the best freshman in the league. But holy hell, he is definitely the best freshman in the league right now. And I put out the other day, I can't remember the last time that GW has had a big forward who can score and defend like this. Like, the mind just immediately goes back to Watanabe and Garino. And I don't even want to say it because that's such a vaunted territory to go into. Two guys who were like legitimately playing big minutes at worldwide international events now for their countries. Watanabe being the spark plug shooter off the bench for the Phoenix Suns. But like, that's the last great comparison we have for Johnson at this point. Is scoring output through those four games, 21, 15, 15, and then 18 again. His worst rebounding game was six. This, and he's a good versatile defender as well. He just has everything that you want in your power forward in a league that, as we've talked about so many times, is often devoid of true power forwards. But this is a guy who can rough it up when teams want to just play two centers against him. And then can space the floor on those dudes on the other way. And I think he's going to be a matchup nightmare as I look around this conference for basically every team except for really the top four. Duquesne, VCU, Dayton, and Bonaventure have guys that can match up with him. And other than that, he is just going to destroy the bottom teams in this conference, not just this year, but for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, I really don't have that much to add. I think the fact that he's playing at all this year is a terrific story, but it's even better when you consider that not just one of the best freshmen in the league, but he's been one of the best players, period. And that's a huge reason for GW's success. The other freshman, though, I do want to shout out for this is a breakout we didn't expect. I think we have to give some credit to Bobby Buckets, Bobby Durkin over at Davidson, hitting some really clutch shots in the Maryland game, which might not be a huge win because Maryland's struggling, but still very exciting for the Wildcats. And he's looking like just another guy on the long list of freshmen who immediately contribute for Davidson. And we were wondering who was going to be able to shoot from distance on that team. And so far, he's 50% on the year, which has been a terrific boost for the Wildcats.
Yeah, we weren't sure which freshman it was that was going to contribute. I'm going with Bobby Big Shot. That's what I want for his nickname after he hit the game winner against Maryland. But yeah, to me, he's been the most impressive guy on Davidson so far. Outside the fact that David Skogman is just having an awesome start to the year, but Durkin probably needs to start soon because Reed Bailey's not rebounding again, guys. Same rebounding rate as Grant Huffman. So you can take that as Bailey's an awful rebounder or Grant Huffman's a great one for 6'3". It's a little bit of both.
All right, so the next breakout category you had, or not really breakout, but you wanted us to pick a player that our dads would enjoy.
So this
Clarify
is,
those.
so we're gonna, I want this to like become an actual thing. Like we have dad jokes. We need dad texts. And I'm stealing this from J. Kyle Mann, an excellent NBA writer over at The Ringer, who was praising Toumani Kamara, who, by the way, got legitimate airtime on two of the best NBA pods last week. And for anyone not paying attention, Toumani Kamara is either the sixth or seventh man for the Trailblazers, is already a significantly above average defender in the NBA, and is a guy who is now all of a sudden looking like he's going to carve out a 10 to 12 year NBA career. And to already be at that place after 1 month as a second round pick is incredible. But the comment that was made talking about Kamara is that if I'm trying to remember this exactly, but if you look up the texts of all of the basketball fans in Portland and the people who are praising Toumani Kamara, it's probably just a bunch of dads, which immediately took me to the fact that over the last like 10 years in college basketball, I got more texts from my dad about how much he loved watching Toumani Kamara last year than any other player. And so I think we have to figure out who the dad text guy is, which is just that kind of like maybe not the flashiest dude, well, definitely not the flashiest dude out there, but just an awesome guy who's definitely scrappy, does some dirty work, but puts up some numbers as well. And for me, I want to kick it off with Terrence Hargrove Jr., who is playing small ball five for, as we talked about, a St. Louis team that they did get Bruce Jean, so they do have a center, but they only have one. And they're throwing out the 6'5" Terrence Hargrove Jr. to have to deal with that position. He had three different and ones in a Wichita State game where basically no one else on the Billikens showed up, ended up with 21-7 in that game. He had a 27-15 against Southern Indiana in their season opener. He's one of the best rebounders in the conference. He is an awesome, scrappy dude. And on a St. Louis team that, and we should mention, that could have been the team that we talked about moving up. And they lose Sincere Parker in the for the season in the middle of the best game of his life. And just don't question the year from hell. It's the year from hell for the Billikens, for everyone except for Terrence Hargrove, who has just been a delight this year.
Yeah, I kind of feel like that's what we need to root for with St. Louis. I mean, Hargrove's been a fun player to watch for years, and now it seems like he's finally going to get his shot to be the go-to guy on that team. I don't know if I understood the assignment. I went with Keyshawn Hall, who we already talked about. I kind of feel like he does some of the same things as Toumani Kamara did in college, just a bigger guy that can still handle the ball well, gets a ton of rebounds, can shoot the three, just I don't know. I thought of him as a good all-around player, but if we're looking for scrappy, I don't know if that's the right answer
Well,
necessarily.
Mason has multiple of those guys because Amari Kelly was also someone I thought about.
Yeah. I mean, I think just a good defensive team like that, you could pick multiple guys that can kind of grind on that end of the court.
All right, the last one, the Pappy McPoyle Award. And for those who know the Trial of the Century episode of Always Sunny in Philadelphia, Pappy McPoyle, who I discovered today is played by Guillermo del Toro, apparently. He is this bearded, backwoods, raving lunatic, the patriarch of the craziest family in the show. And if anyone wants to take the time to look up the 2-minute clip, it won't make any sense anyway. But he's just sitting on a trial stand, just basically screaming about nonsense, trying to hide the fact that his murderous bird is hiding under his hat the whole time. And his rantings just came to my mind of what player is going to make us feel that way this season? And for me, I thought about a guy who has already shown some unbelievable flashes, but I know is just going to make some maddening plays on the opposite direction. And that is Jakob Nechas on Duquesne, a 6'8 shooting guard who I don't know if he's listed at 6'8 just to make it not be weird that he's a guard, But that dude is definitely 6'10", because I can tell you from up close, he's a good 3 inches taller than the Drame twins, who I'm pretty sure are actually accurately listed at 6'7". But this dude is a 6'10 shooting guard who can shoot the three decently well and rebounds and can protect the rim. He had two, like, smack the ball into the stands off of a rotation blocks against Ryder on Friday night that were, well, it was like Wemby level stuff. It's completely insane. And at the same time, 75% of the time that he's on the court, he looks like he has truly no idea what he's supposed to be doing out there. And I think that he's going to go through stretches in like January where he literally doesn't play for weeks at a time because he's just doing stupid things out there. But the talent is unbelievable.
This is a good one. This was pretty easy for me, and I had to go with a new player to the conference, but I think Patrick Mwamba of Loyola Chicago, like, you can tell he's very talented. He's been on some very good mid-major teams over his career, and I mean, he's got a nice looking shot. He's a really good rebounder, but I mean, in the first couple games of the year, we've already seen multiple airball threes. He had maybe the funniest
He can't
intentional foul I've
shoot.
ever seen against Florida Atlantic, where on a 2-on-1 fast break, he just shoved the player without the ball in the back, which I think it ended up being like a 5 or 6 point play because it was two shots and the ball and the basket counted or something crazy. I don't know. He just seems prone to making funny mistakes. But I mean, he can also make some highlight reel plays, which are going to be thrilling to watch.
He to me. And this is maybe taking out a little bit of that highlight reel ability. He reminds me of like a modern day version of like what Amir Johnson would be if he just came around 20 years later. Just an absolute brick house, an amazing rebounder, and a great defender for his position, who I kind of hope we don't have to watch take a three the entire rest of the season. And he's actually made a few this year, which is the most remarkable part, but
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. He'll knock down some shots and look just smooth out there, but then he'll just make you scratch your head. It's funny, especially considering I think he's a fifth-year player now. But
yeah, he is.
I mean, a lot of things about Loyola just don't make sense too, and he fits right in on that team.
All right,
All
final
right.
thing. We got one big tournament coming up this week, and that's VCU heading down to Orlando. We haven't talked much about the Rams, who dropped their opening night game to McNeese State, proceeded to give their fans two more heart attacks against Samford and Seattle. But here they sit, 3-1. Just like I said, they were going to drop a bye game and hopefully take care of the rest. And it's going into Orlando. I just wish they had Sean Bairstow. Because this team just they need another guy who actually makes his threes.
Well, I think that's one of the head-scratching things for VCU, and we saw it last year with Utah State, a team that took a ton of threes and they were very good at it. Right now, you mentioned Dayton having some of the Billy Lang syndrome. I think that's VCU shooting 28%, although they're taking a ton of attempts. And I just don't know if it's the right guys. They've got Zeb Jackson, who through 4 games is 6 for
Yeah,
27.
that's the wrong
And
guy.
I mean, he's putting up good numbers overall. He's still a menace on defense. He has a ton of assists this year, and he's doing a great job with the offense, but he's taking some audacious threes. And then a couple newcomers, Kwani Kwani is 0 for 10, Michael Bell's 0 for 8. You'd think those guys are going to turn around at some point, but outside of Shulga, they're just not getting a whole lot of production on the outside right now.
Other than Jason Nelson, who started off horribly, I don't think he made a three the first two games and then got hot this week. But the problem for VCU, and their defense has been awesome this year, but they may have to give up a little bit because they're basically starting one shooter, and that's Shulga, with Jackson next to him. Michael Bell, who's 0 for 8 on the year, is already looking like an awesome defender at the small forward position. Kawani Kawani, and then just whoever their center is that day. But I just listed off a whole hell of a lot of non-shooters who are all making great contributions to this team. But I think they probably have to find a way that to play less minutes for a Kawani Kawani or a Michael Bell and just get Fats Billups into the lineup more, because he's at least going to give you some okay shooting. He's at least a threat from out there. But yeah, other than Shulga and Jason Nelson, I really don't trust anyone from the outside for VCU.
Yeah, and at least Billups is still a super lanky and quick guy that I think can hold his own on defense. That part doesn't really worry me. The other issue is just that turnovers have been sky high for the Rams, which is kind of uncharacteristic based on...
Roosevelt Wheeler, 92% turnover rate, which yeah, I don't know how that's mathematically possible.
I've never seen that in KenPom, but that was wild. They also list him as a point guard, which is kind of funny right now, but I think it's just because he has so many turnovers and not enough rebounds to be a center. But you would think that's going to clean up. I mean, it's just an entirely new team playing for a new coach. It's going to take some time. And I do think it's a good thing that VCU started with four pretty difficult opponents. I mean, they're all inside the top 200. Not easy bye game, you know, cupcakes, that, not to throw GW under the bus, but it's a way tougher schedule. And so they have a big opportunity going to Orlando for the ESPN Events Invitational, starting off with Iowa State. That's always a really good field. We saw Dayton have a lot of success there 2 years ago. What do you think they need to do to hang with a legit top 25 team like Iowa State?
Well, it's a tough start for VCU because they get probably the best team in this tournament to kick things off. Now, the Cyclones, all they've done is just beat the bejesus out of four terrible teams so far this year, but their margin of victory is through the roof. Their worst performance so far this year is actually beating Idaho State by a mere 29. They're just annihilating teams. And so all of their numbers look incredible. Third-ranked defense, according to KenPom. And VCU's problem is going to be that they've been the best guarding inside the arc all year, while also forcing the most steals in the nation. So it runs exactly perfectly to all of the things we just said. They're probably going to be able to turn the Rams over. And in this game, I think you're going to be relying on Max Shulga to really just put up a stellar superstar performance. I think the way that things are going for the Rams right now and the way that this Iowa State defense is going to play, they're going to need their best guy to come up with something big, like a 26 and maybe 6 or 7 assists as well. I think the hope for the Rams probably lies in trying to pick up a pair of wins later in the week, though.
Yeah, I mean, there's still a lot of good opportunities, even if VCU does lose the first game. And sadly, as a quick precursor to our final segment, former Ram Hassan Moore will not be playing for Iowa State as he recovers from an injury, but I mean, you would hope part of it just with VCU playing a lot tougher of a schedule than Iowa State so far. Maybe they're more prepared for that. But we will see. I mean, this is where we talk about every year how the A-10 needs to make the most of these MTEs. And I think VCU, besides maybe Dayton this past week, has as good of an opportunity as anyone in the conference this next few days.
Yeah, and if they do dip into that loser's bracket, maybe they can get themselves right if they end up playing Virginia Tech, who's had actually one of the worst three-point defenses in the nation. And you know VCU would love to stick it to an in-state rival who refuses to play them. And let's just keep in mind, last day of the tournament, they could play Penn State and Mike Rhodes. And no matter where it happens in the bracket, this has to happen.
Oh, I hope so. And we don't need to worry about Penn State lighting up with a ton of threes and lighting up the scoreboard. I mean, it's the same coach and a bunch of the same players, so we kind of know what it's going to look like.
Yeah, we'll take it into our closing segment here. Another edition of Where He At?
All right, well, for my pick this week, and for anyone not familiar, we take a former A-10 player and give you a little look into where they are in their career right now. You know, St. Louis, after just getting punched in the mouth the last 2 days of their tournament, they need some toughness. And just looking through some of their old players, I think they really wish they had Jimmy Bell Jr. right now. a guy who's nearly averaging a double-double. He's just under 10 points and rebounds for the 5-0 Mississippi State Bulldogs, who is looking like a really good team so far. And you just look at St. Louis now, how they don't have anywhere near that physicality. You briefly talked about Bruce Zhang, and he's 7-1, but he's putting up Reed Bailey rebounding numbers. He's hardly doing anything on that end right now. And it's a Billiken team that just doesn't have the skill it used to, and they could really use a big body like that, just in the middle, blocking shots and just affecting everything on defense.
It's funny that you picked one of my favorite guys because I picked one of your favorites, and that is Christian Ray down at
Oh.
Delaware, who, by the way, in his Twitter bio now lists himself as a quote unquote plant-based athlete. So good for him, I guess. Two incredible Christian Ray stats, and it goes along with the guy that we saw back at LaSalle. First off, he has played 120 minutes this year. He has zero turnovers.
Beautiful.
I couldn't fully confirm it, but I believe that that is the highest amount of minutes of anyone in the country who has not turned the ball over yet. And then he is putting up the same number of points and rebounds on the season. 39 of each through 4 games for a good 9.8 average. Not a stellar points number at all, but tied for 40th in the nation in rebounding. And remember, he is still only 6'6".
That is awesome. See, that is perfect. Both of our answers today, I feel like it's guys that you think of, like, how the hell are they still in college? I guess, are
I
they both
definitely thought
COVID year
Christian Ray
guys?
was done last year.
Yeah, I can't believe it. All right. Any final thoughts on the first 2 weeks of the season? I just have one, and then I'm ready to close it out.
Well, I have one unrehearsed stat of the day. Because we
Oh,
talk
okay.
about all of VCU's terrible turnover problems. And one team that I think put up a pretty strong showing in the first 2 weeks, at least relative to what I expected, but their crosstown rivals over in Richmond, Chris Mooney needs to go give a clinic to the Rams on how to take care of the ball. Third in the nation in turnover percentage for the Spiders. They have three different rotation players who are in the Christian Ray zone of never giving up the ball. Isaiah Bigelow has not turned it over yet. Jason Roach, actually, sorry, there's four. Bigelow, Roach, Jai Bailey, and Aiden Noyes all have not turned the ball over yet this season.
That is awesome. Yeah, we didn't talk about Richmond much, but they are getting some good guard play. Jordan King is, he is a baller. We're going to be talking about him a lot this year. And
And by the
I
way,
almost wanted, sorry, go
oh,
ahead.
I was just going to throw in King and Delonnie Hunt, both top 200 in the nation in turnover rate.
Yeah.
Like everyone's taking care of the ball on this team except for Mike Walls.
Well, he can't be playing that much. But he's learning the Grant Golden, Matt Grace backup center role for now. All right, my final takeaway from the first 2 weeks. I had the pleasure of going to the Charleston Classic to watch Dayton. Awesome vacation. First time for me in Charleston. Loved the city, the beach, and everything. And my stat of the day, Charleston is 2-3. They don't need to be in the A-10. I don't care about what you think about the city of Charleston. You can go visit on your own time. I would recommend it. It was fantastic. But they're just not that good of a basketball program. They were awesome last year. They pop up every few years as a good mid-major. But I'm looking in the TD Arena, which is a good venue. But they have some first and second round banners, and that's it. Talk to me when you go to a Sweet 16, but we don't need Charleston in the A-10. I'm sorry. Just had to get that off my chest one more time.
Well, I said it from the beginning. You have to back up the great last season. And hopefully they do because Duquesne could really use that being a quality win. But I
Yeah,
want to
they
close
also still
things.
play Rhodey and St. Joe's too. They have two more
Yeah.
A-10 games.
And I want to close things out here. Everyone can kind of timestamp where we're at right now. But we're early in the first half, and St. Joe's is significantly out rebounding Kentucky, which is a statement that I didn't not ever think that I would be able to make in the Billy Lang era.
All right. Let's go, Hawks.
We'll see. That should do it for this episode of the Three Bid League podcast. If St. Joe's wins this game, we might keep going after this. So if you still see a bunch of minutes left on your ticker, it means we had an awesome upset on this Monday night. But if not, we thank you for listening to this episode. Please leave us 5 stars on iTunes if you enjoyed it. Leave us a review on there. Send us any comments at Twitter on Twitter at 3BidLeaguePod. Same name over on Blue Sky, or shoot us an email, 3BidLeague@gmail.com. Everybody enjoy this Thanksgiving weekend. Hopefully VCU gives us something to be thankful for that day against Iowa State. Or Loyola, who I do believe does play their second game of their tournament on Thanksgiving Day. So a lot of great basketball coming up this week. We didn't talk about it at all. St. Mary's Davidson on Friday could be a huge game for both of those teams. I know I'm personally getting excited about that one. So everyone enjoy. We will be back next week.